Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 3, verses 1 through 29, which I will entitle The Defeat of Og of Bashan. King Og the Amorite is going down. At the end of the chapter, we will see that Moses is forbidden by God to enter into the Promised Land. Our context is this. At the tail end of Deuteronomy 2, we saw the defeat of Og's fellow Amorite king, King Sihon, who ruled the southern area. The Amorites had conquered the Moabites in the south and the Ammonites in the north. And so the former Moabite territory was from the Arnon River, from the Brook Zered, south of the Dead Sea, all the way up to the Arnon River. And then we go from the Arnon River up to the north of the Dead Sea, the northern tip where Heshbon is. Between the Arnon River and Heshbon, we can safely assume that King Og had conquered that, and maybe even below that too, I'm not sure. And then from Heshbon at the north of the northern tip of the Dead Sea, all the way up to the Jabbok River, which intersects the Jordan River running east to west, roughly halfway up, that was the former territory of the Ammonites, and Og of Bashan had conquered that. He'd also conquered even beyond the Jabbok River all the way up to the Yarmouk River, which runs into the Sea of Galilee, right to the south of the Sea of Galilee. And Bashan actually was even further north of that, going up into the Golan Heights area to the east of the Sea of Galilee, and even further north than that as you go northeast from Galilee up towards Syria, and southeast from Mount Hermon, which is at the very northern edge of Israel, that area up there, right before you get to Syria. Og of Bashan had that territory. And so now we're going to see Israel conquering Og. So then, after Sihon was conquered, we turned and went up the road to Bashan. That road is the king's highway. And Bashan, I've just described to you where it is. Let's just say from the river Jabbok all the way up to the area to the east of the Sea of Galilee, where the Golan Heights are today. We went up the road to Bashan, and Og, king of Bashan, with all his people, came out to meet us and battle at Edrei. Now, if you look at the map, Edrei is on the Yarmouk River, or close to the Yarmouk River, where the king's highway crosses it. It's a good ways to the east of the Jordan River, sort of at the headwaters of near the source of the Yarmouk River, and that was a famous battle there. We've already talked about that. Israel clobbered Og there. Verse 2, but the Lord said to me, do not fear him, for I have delivered him and all his people and his land into your hand, and you shall do to him just as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon. Well, we saw in the last chapter, Moses clobbered, in fact, wiped out their cities, killed all the men, women, and children, just completely destroyed everything of Sihon the Amorite. And he asked for it because Sihon refused to let Moses go through, which Moses was peacefully willing to do. He said, I'll buy my food, I'll buy my water, just let us walk up the highway, take a left here, go east, cross the Jordan River, let us through, won't be any problem. But no, Sihon's got to go out and fight him. He lived to rue the day. Now this name, Bashan, is probably the same meaning as a cognate Arabic word, which means soft, fertile land. We tend to think of Bashan as fertile because of the ox and the cattle there. The cognate Arabic word can also mean another one. Similar word can mean this land sown with wheat or wheat land. So anyway, you get the idea. It's a rich and fruitful place. Now in verse 1, Og with all his people came out to meet us in battle at Edrei, and came out from Ashtaroth, which was Og's city. If you go up from Edrei, which is on the Yarmouk River, and go north all the way up to the Golan Heights, to the east of the Golan Heights, which is east of the Sea of Galilee, there's a city called Ashtaroth, and that's where Og was from. He was not provoked. He just attacked, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out. Why? Well, here's some options as to why. He disliked the presence of such powerful neighbors. Israel was not going to go up there and mess with them, but they're a powerful 600,000 strong army. Perhaps Og wanted to avenge the overthrow of Sihon, his friend, and the allies that were fighting there, whoever they were. Maybe he just wanted some revenge. But for whatever reason, he came down to Edrei, and he also made a bad career move. We read in verses 3 through 7. So the Lord our God delivered Og, also king of Bashan, with all his people into our hand. Now remember, I need to give some context here. Moses is recounting what happened in the past in the 40th year of the exile. he is giving a speech to the children of Israel at the very end of the 40th year, but he's reminiscing a little bit what happened just a few months before within that same 40th year. So the Lord our God delivered Og also, king of Bashan, with all his people into our hand, and we smote them until no survivor was left. We captured all his cities at that time. There was not a city which we did not take from them. 60 cities, all the region of Argob, the kingdom of Og in Bashan. Argob is basically coterminous with Bashan. They don't know exactly where it is, but it's just basically a region in Bashan. I've already described Bashan to the northeast of the Sea of Galilee and to the northwest of the Sea of Galilee and to the southeast of Mount Hermon. That's basically the area you're talking about. There were 60 cities there in that region of Argob, which was in Bashan, and they were all captured. Verse 5, all these were cities fortified with high walls, gates, and bars, besides a great many unwalled towns. So we got 60 cities conquered, and then also a bunch of cities that weren't fortified. Verse 6, we utterly destroyed them, as we did to Sihon, king of Heshbon, utterly destroying the men, women, and children of every city. But all the animals and the spoil of the cities we took as our booty. That word destroy there, as I mentioned in the last chapter, as we were talking about Sihon, it means to devote to destruction. It means anything that can be destroyed is destroyed, but including people. But there's an exception for animals because the troops needed booty. And it says right here in verse 7, all the animals and spoil of the city we took as our booty. And all gold and silver and things that could not be destroyed by fire, they're saved also, probably handed over to Moses. Whereas everything else is burnt to the ground. And of course, we have the common problem. How could a loving God do this? Folks, if you end up for decades and centuries involved in total rebellion against God, you reap for yourself the wages of sin, which is death. Those women and children would not have grown up any more godly than the men were. They would have insisted on their horrible rebellion against God. They would have kept right on with it, and they would have born more men who would have created soldiers who would have tried to come across the Jordan River and wipe out the Israelites, as well as destroy the Israelites on the east side. So they had to be totally destroyed. Now, these 60 cities were large and walled. It says in verse 5, they were fortified with high walls, gates, and bars, hard to get to, hard to beat, but they were beaten. 1 Kings 4:13 mentions these cities, Ben-Geber and Ramoth-Gilead, the towns of Jair, the son of Manasseh, which are in Gilead, were his, the region of Argob. I'm not going to go through the geography of 1 Kings. We'll do it when we get there. But the region of Argob, that's that same plain that we just mentioned, which is in Bashan. It's a region of Bashan. And there were 60 great cities there with walls and bronze bars. So these 60 cities were remembered even in Joshua's time. These were the same sort of cities the disbelieving spies thought the Israelites could not take, Numbers 13:28. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. That's the giants. So these fortified cities, the fortification is mentioned because it took God to overcome those fortifications. It was a difficult military feat that they were engaged in. We go now to Deuteronomy 3, verses 8 and 9. Thus we took the land at that time from the hand of the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan. Beyond the Jordan means east of the Jordan, the Transjordan area. And these two kings of the Amorites, from the valley of Arnon to Mount Hermon. Sidonians call Hermon Sirion, and the Amorites call it Senir. All right, well, here's a big geographical landmark that's mentioned, Mount Hermon. We need to start off with that. If you will look at the map of Israel, at the very northernmost tip, there's a huge, it's more like a mountain range. In fact, it's the southern end of the Anti-Lebanon mountain range. Present-day Lebanon, ancient Phoenicia, had two mountain ranges running north and south right through the spine of the country, which was called back then Coele Syria, C-O-E-L-E, Coele Syria. And those two mountain ranges went north to south, and the westernmost mountain range was called the Lebanon range, and the easternmost range was called the Anti-Lebanon range, because it was opposite of the Lebanon range. The valley in between was called the Baca Valley. And then at the southern end of that valley was the Leontes River. The ancient name is Leontes. It's Latani today. And then in the northern part of that valley, that Leontes River or Latani River flows south and then west out into the Mediterranean. And then at the northern end of that valley is the Orontes River, which runs north and ends up in a lake somewhere. And this is a very prominent range. Well, if you look at the Anti-Lebanon Range and go south at the very tip of it, that's right where northern Israel reaches, the southern portion of Mount Hermon, and then Syria is to the east and Lebanon is to the west. So Mount Hermon is right where Lebanon and Syria and Israel come together. Now, Mount Hermon is mentioned many times in the Bible, New Testament as well as Old, and you need to look at it because it's such an interesting mountain. It's huge, and it's snow-capped all year long, as the NIV Study Bible says. I've got a picture here, which I wish you could see. It's over 9,200 feet high, which is pretty high for a mountain. Get to where you can't have oxygen at the top. Snow all year long. NIV Study Bible says it is one of the most prominent and beautiful mountains of Lebanon. Jameson Fawcett Brown, as well as Wikipedia, say that Mount Hermon is the majestic hill on which the long and elevated range of Anti-Lebanon terminates, as I just said. It's the southern tip of that mountain range. Jameson Fawcett Brown say that Mount Hermon is not so much one high mountain as a whole cluster of mountain peaks, and this might explain why different people gave it different names. They named different peaks. We see here the Jews call it Mount Hermon, the Sidonians, that's the people of Phoenicia, which is not too far to the west. You go to the west a little bit, not very far, and you end up in the Mediterranean Sea. And, of course, the Sidonians were on the Mediterranean Sea there to the north of Israel. The Sidonians call Hermon Sirion. Now, the NIV Study Bible says that this word Sirion has been found in a Canaanite document, which is contemporaneous with Moses. So a little bit of historical buttressing of the authority of the scriptures here. Now, the Sidonians called Mount Hermon Sirion. The Amorites, who are now being dispossessed by the Israelites, Og of Bashan is an Amorite. I haven't mentioned this in this audio. The Amorites were the most prominent Canaanite tribe. They were beyond Canaan a lot of times. They sometimes went into Syria at some point in times in history. They ended up in the Mesopotamian Valley. They are, I think they're called the Amuri in the Egyptian documents. They're fair-skinned and red-headed, which makes them a little distinct from all the Semite races there, the Jews and the Egyptians. So that's an interesting tribe. There's a lot of information on them. And the Amorites there, Og of Bashan, he would call that mountain Senir. I read somewhere that's the only Amorite word that exists, Senir. The word is also found in Assyrian sources, interestingly enough, in the Assyrian monuments. Another little piece of evidence showing that Moses was a good historian. He didn't need to put all this stuff in there about who calls what, but it makes it real when you realize that he's naming places he could see. So Moses summarizes the victory over the Amorites, the two kings, not just one king, but Sihon and Og both, from the Valley of Arnon, that's halfway down south, from the tip of the northern tip of the Dead Sea to the Arnon River, which bisects Moab, from that valley all the way up to the tip of the Dead Sea, all the way up further, halfway up to Mount to Sea of Galilee, which is the Jabbok River, going all the way almost till you get to the Sea of Galilee. That's the Yarmouk River, and then we go even further beyond that, and we get to the Golan Heights, and we go even further than that to the east of Mount Hermon and to Argob of the land of Bashan. All of that was taken from the Amorites. A big victory. We go now to Deuteronomy chapter 3, verses 10 and 11. All the cities of the plateau and all Gilead and all Bashan as far as Salika and Edrei, cities of the kingdom of Og in Bashan. For only Og, king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Rephaim. Behold, his bedstead was an iron bedstead. It is in Rabbah of the sons of Ammon. Its length was 9 cubits and its width 4 cubits by ordinary cubit. All right, there's a lot of geography here, so let's get started. Verse 10, all the cities of the plateau, referring to cities of the plateau that the Israelites had conquered. Moses was referring to that. That would be the plains around Heshbon and her cities. That's Sihon's cities. Moses wiped them out. All Gilead, I'm assuming that is the valley that's east of the Jordan River, running from the northern tip of the Dead Sea all the way to the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee along the Arab Valley. That's Gilead, and also a little bit to the east of the valley there because there's a range of hills there that's part of Gilead. So that's all called Gilead. And, of course, up to the Jabbok River was taken from Sihon. And then once you get to the Jabbok River and go north, roughly speaking, you go north of that is Og of Bashan's territory. So that means Sihon took the former Moabite territory from the Arnon River up to Heshbon, north of the Dead Sea, at the northern tip of the Dead Sea. And then from Heshbon up to the Yarmouk River, that was the former territory. From Heshbon to the Jabbok River, that was the former territory of Ammon. So it's confusing because the Amorites took over former territory of Moab and Ammon, and the maps always show Moab and Ammon. They don't show the Amorites. I guess they weren't there long enough to get a spot on the map. So anyway, Moses says all the way from all the cities of the plateau, that's the plains of Moab, the plateau, that word there is used several times in the Old Testament. It always means the plains of Moab, which are where Mount Pisgah is. You need to look at a map there because that's a famous place. And so from the cities of the plateau, and then we go north of there up the Jordan River Valley and a little bit east of there in those hills with Gilead. We got those two. Gilead up to Jabbok was taken from Sihon, and north of Jabbok was taken from Og. And go even further north of that, of the Yarmouk River, we get all of Bashan. As far as Salika, that would be a city on the eastern edge of Bashan, otherwise unknown, mentioned again in Joshua. And then Edrei, which was where the famous battle was, where the Israelites clobbered Og, the city which is just south on the King's Highway from Ashtaroth, which is due east of the Sea of Galilee. Og came out of Ashtaroth, went down south to Edrei, right near where the King's Highway intersects the Yarmouk River, and Israel whopped them. And verse 11 itself is a parenthesis. For only Og, king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Riphaim. Now the parenthesis is about how big King Og was. Only Og was left. Well, that means only Og in the Transjordan River. There were some more Riphaim mentioned later on in Scripture. They weren't wiped out. But he was the last one in the Transjordan area. Well, who were the Riphaim? The Riphaim of the giants. The Riphaim, the Anakim, the Emin, the Zamzumin. If I left one of them out, the Anakim. Yes. You see those names? Think giant. Now, because Og was an aboriginal giant, his height might have helped him get elevated to the throne. That wouldn't surprise me in the least. By the way, these giants, they might have been related to each other. That's why they get a different name, but they're still giants. Or they might be the same tribe, but they are in a different territory, so the geography distinguishes them, and the different tribes there with different languages gave them different names. But again, let me repeat those names. Rephaim, Anakim, Emim, who were in Moab, and Zamzumin, who were in Ammon. You see those names, think giants. Not necessarily related to the Nephilim in Genesis 6. Not necessarily. That was a long time ago. Now, this bedstead of Og ended up in Rabbah. Now, Rabbah is either called Rabbah or Rabbath Ammon, and it is the current-day Ammon. It's south of the Jabbok River. I always have trouble keeping it straight from Ramoth Gilead, which is north of the Jabbok River on the King's Highway. So this Rabbah is a famous city. It's still there today. It's Ammon. It's the capital of Jordan today, Ammon. Well, the next question is, well, let's talk about a little bit more about Rabbah, where this bedspread was. In ancient times, it was called Philadelphia, interestingly enough. As the NIV Study Bible says, it was the capital of ancient Ammon, even as today is the capital of the country of Jordan. It's mentioned in Amos 1, verses 13 through 14. Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of the sons of Ammon, and for four I will not revoke its punishment, because they ripped open the pregnant women of Gilead in order to enlarge their borders. So I will kindle a fire on the wall of Rabbah, that's Rabbath Ammon, and it will consume her citadels amid war cries on the day of battle and a storm on the day of tempest. In other words, it was a pagan city. Sounds like New York City. But these people were even worse than the gangs that roamed the streets of New York City. These people ripped open the pregnant women of Gilead. You're ripping open a pregnant woman, you're pretty much a barbarian. Rabbath Ammon, or Rabbah, was mentioned in 2 Samuel 12:26. Now Joab fought against Rabbah of the sons of Ammon and captured the royal city. That's when David sent his general up there. So we need to know where that city is. Now, the next question is how did this giant Og, how did his bedstead end up in Ammon? Well, here's three options. One, there might have been some battles between the Amorites and the Ammonites, one of which the Ammonites might have won. I know the Amorites ended up eventually conquering the whole territory, but that doesn't necessarily mean they won every battle. The Ammonites might have won one battle and carried off Og's bed from Ashtaroth, I guess is where his bed was. That was his capital. That's Adam Clark's idea. Your second option. Maybe Og, before his battle with the Israelites at Edrei, maybe he sent it on down south to Rabbah for safety. In other words, maybe he was worried about his bed. That was Jameson Fawcett and Brown's idea. Jameson Fawcett and Brown also had another idea, option three, that Moses captured it in the battle at Edrei, and then he sold it to the Ammonites. And then the Ammonites kept it as an antiquarian curiosity until Rabbah was sacked by David during David's time. Jameson Fawcett and Brown mentioned that, but they think that's most unlikely. Well, I don't know how the bed got to Ammon, but it's interesting that it would be mentioned here in a parenthesis. And the reason was, I'm sure, is to say, hey, he was big, he was mighty, he was a giant, but we whooped his fanny. It's a great parenthesis, I must say. How big was this bed? Well, 9 cubits is more than 13 feet, according to the NIV. If you take a cubit as a foot and a half, 9 times a foot and a half is 13 and a half feet. It's 4 cubits wide. If a cubit's a foot and a half, that's 6 feet wide. Well, 13 feet long and 6 feet wide, that doesn't necessarily mean that Og was that big. He might have wanted some extra room in his bed. Well, that's a pretty big bed, even by today's standards. Measured by the ordinary cubit, it says in verse 11, the ordinary cubit is opposed to a royal cubit or king's cubit, which was longer than a foot and a half. This is the ordinary cubit. So we know how big Og's bed was for all of you playing Bible trivia. We go down to Deuteronomy chapter 3, verses 12 through 13. So we took possession of this land at that time. Let's talk about Bashan. Bashan and south of Bashan, the Ammonites and the Moabites land. So we took possession of this land at that time from Aroer, which is by the valley of Arnon, and half the country of Gilead, and its cities I gave to the Reubenites and to the Gadites. The rest of Gilead and all Bashan, the kingdom of Og, I gave to the half-tribe of Manasseh, all the region of Argob. Concerning all Bashan, it is called the land of Rephaim, the land of giants. All right, we got some more geography here. Aroer is a city right to the north of the Arnon River, right at its headwaters, or near its headwaters, in those high mountains there, from which the Arnon River flows into the Dead Sea, halfway up Moab to the east of the Dead Sea. So from the Arnon, and let me say this, the Arnon River, from the south of the Arnon River to the Brook Zered, which is at the south of the Dead Sea, that's Moab proper. That's what Moses was not supposed to touch. But when you get to the north of Aroer, that land passed back and forth several times, and now the Amorites had it, and the Israelites took it from the Amorites. Now, this land, all of this land which we've talked about, was divided up between 2.5 tribes, Reuben, Gad, and half Manasseh. So we need to look at a map and see where those tribes ended up with their territory. If we go from the Arnon River to Heshbon and draw a line from the northern tip of the Dead Sea through Heshbon, that's Reuben. That's the part of Moab which we'll call Moab, but not necessarily Moab proper because they gained it and lost it a lot. But that's the tribe of Reuben. Now, if you go from Heshbon all the way up to the Jabbok River, which is halfway up the Jordan River to the Sea of Galilee, maybe a third of the way up might be more accurate, from Heshbon to the Jabbok, that belongs to Gad. And that's where the sons of Ammon lived. Now, if we go from the Jabbok River, again, this is rough. We go from the Jabbok River up to the Yarmouk River, past the Yarmouk River, still going north, through the Golan Heights east of the Sea of Galilee, still going north to the southeast of Mount Hermon. That is half Manasseh. Now, that more or less describes these two verses, Deuteronomy 3, 12 through 13. Let me mention some stuff I didn't mention when I just gave you the overall picture, geographical picture. Moses said that he gave half the hill country of Gilead to the Reubenites. If you go, Gilead runs from the northern tip of the Dead Sea to the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. If you go up to the Jabbok River, that's roughly half of the hill country. Now, half of that hill country was given to a collection of two tribes, the Reubenites and the Gadites. Well, it was the Gadites who mainly had that area, but he runs the Reubenites and the Gadites together. Now, half of the hill country went to Gilead. The other half, the northern half of Gilead, went to half Manasseh. And it says that in verse 13, the rest of Gilead, once you get past the Jabbok River, and all Bashan, once you get past the Sea of Galilee, the kingdom of Og, I gave to the half-tribe of Manasseh. All the region of Argob, Argob was a region of Bashan. It is called the land of Ephraim the giants. All right, this is hard talking about geography. I'm sure you're having trouble listening to it, but that's basically how it works. We go now to Deuteronomy 3, verses 14 and 15. Jair, the son of Manasseh, took all the region of Argob as far as the border of the Geshurites and the Maacathites, and called it, that is, Bashan, after his own name, Havoth-Jair, as it is to this day. To Machir I gave Gilead. All right, Jair and Machir are two sons of Manasseh. So now we're going to look closer into the tribe of half Manasseh. I gave you their rough territory from the Jabbok River all the way up to southeast of Mount Hermon, but there were some parts of that they didn't have because they were two Syrian or Aramean cities, countries, little kinglets, kingdoms, called Geshurites and Maacathites that they didn't own. So let's see where they are. If you look at a map, Geshur is right to the east of the Sea of Galilee, right where the Golan Heights are. Okay, well, half Manasseh only went up to the border of the Geshurites. Now, the Maacathites, if you will go further north from the Sea of Galilee, past Lake Hula, up to right to the southern end of Mount Hermon and a little bit to the west is Maacah, another Aramean kingdom. Half Manasseh didn't get them, so they had some territory carved out of their territory. But the rest of it belonged, the rest of Bashan was owned by Manasseh. Jair, one of the sons of Manasseh, took all the cities in his area, and he called it Havoth-Jair. Havoth-Jair means the settlements of Jair, as the NIV translates it. These were the 60 cities of Bashan that had been captured, the highly fortified cities. They were not entirely destroyed. They were captured. I say they were not entirely destroyed. I hope that's not what the text says. It says, well, it does say, it says, we utterly destroyed them, the 60 cities. Now, you got to be careful. That destroy can also be translated as devoted. It means that they basically took the city, burnt what they could, took some booty, the animals, but the cities were still there. And so then the Israelites took them over. Now, going back to this little Aramean kingdom of Geshur, which, as I said, is right where the Golan Heights area is now, east of the Dead Sea, east of the Sea of Galilee. That's an interesting place. BibleAtlas.org says that the word Geshur means bridge, an Aramean kingdom of no great size, which lay probably to the south of Maacah, which, of course, is south of Mount Hermon, it's to the Sea of Galilee, and formed with Maacah the western boundary of the land of Bashan. So I guess what BibleAtlas.org is saying is you go all the way from the Sea of Galilee to Mount Hermon, and there's a strip of country there that East Manasseh didn't hold. But what makes Geshur a little bit interesting is that he married the daughter of the king of Geshur. The king's name was Talmai, and the daughter's name, unfortunately, was Maacah, which makes it confusing between the Maacathites, who were to the north. There might be a reason for that that I don't know, but at any rate, Geshur had a king named Talmai, had a daughter named Maacah, and Maacah married King David. And King David and Maacah had a baby, had two babies, Absalom and Tamar, famous offspring, of course, as we will see when we get to 2 Samuel and read all about their story. But Geshur is where Absalom's mother was from, and Tamar's mother also. Verse 15 says, to Machir I gave Gilead. Machir is Manasseh's, I think he's the younger son. It's a different son anyway. I gave Gilead. Now, Gilead, now this is interesting here. Gilead could either be just the normal phrase for the strip of land from the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee to the northern tip of the Dead Sea to the east there, but it also could refer to Ramoth Gilead. And if it does, that makes the territory of Gad look a little strange. Now, the maps, you look at different maps and they have Gad shaped a little bit differently. It depends on how you pronounce, how you interpret that word Gilead. I'll talk about that in a minute when we get to the Gadites. So let's go now to Deuteronomy 3, verses 16 and 17. To the Reubenites and to the Gadites, I gave from Gilead even as far as the valley of Arnon, the middle of the valley as a border, and as far as the river Jabbok. We've already talked about that. If that Gilead there is the valley of Gilead, well, then you're talking about from the Jabbok River, which runs into Gilead right there at the Jordan River, all the way south to the Arnon River in the middle of Moab. The middle of the valley, of Arnon as a border, the southern border, and as far as the river Jabbok, the northern border. All right, not going to talk about that anymore. And the river Jabbok is the border of the sons of Ammon. I've talked about that too. Now, in verse 17, this is an interesting verse. It's talking about to who the Gadites got, or what land they got. The Arabah also with the Jordan as a border from Chinnereth, that's the Sea of Galilee, even as far as the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, at the foot of the slopes of Pisgah on the east. Well, now, if the Gadites got the Arabah, that's the valley that the Jordan River is flowing through, and Jordan is a border, that would be a western border from the Sea of Galilee all the way down to the Dead Sea. That means that when you look at the map of Gad, instead of a rectangle going from Heshbon up to the Jabbok River, Gad extends further. If you look at the rectangle and put two antennae on it, there's a left antenna that goes all the way up the Jordan River Valley, all the way to the Sea of Galilee. And that would be verse 17 causing that, because the Arabah is given to Gad also with the Jordan as a border. That's the western border from the Sea of Galilee. Chinnereth is the Sea of Galilee. Even as far as the Sea of the Arabah, that's the Dead Sea, because the Dead Sea is in that same Arabah Valley. All right, so there's your left antenna. Now, if you take Gilead, I've already mentioned Gilead. Let me go back to that verse. Well, verse 16, to the Reubenites and to the Gadites I gave from Gilead. If that's Ramoth Gilead, then that's a town to the north of the Jabbok River, which means that Gad had some land going from the upper northeast corner of the rectangle that Gad is, from the Jabbok River all the way up to Ramoth Gilead. There's kind of a little sliver of land. Now, I don't think so. That's just the way one map has it. Other maps just have the rectangle. But it seems to me that verse 17 is very clear that the Arabah Valley goes to the tribe of Gad. And of course, then the question is why? It seems to me it would be more logical to give that to the tribes of Manasseh. But if you look at the maps, half Manasseh comes down in a point, a rounded point. And I've often wondered, well, why this? Why not square it off? Well, it's because of this verse 17 where the Arabah Valley was given to the Gadites. Now, this border of the Gadites goes all the way down, the border of the Gadites goes all the way down to the Salt Sea. That's right around Heshbon, and also right around Mount Pisgah at the foot of the slopes of Pisgah. So if you're on Mount Pisgah, you're looking over, you're going to see the Dead Sea to your left, and you look right over where Jerusalem is, or where Jerusalem was going to be. Mount Pisgah may or may not be the same peak as Mount Nebo. Mount Nebo and Mount Pisgah are mentioned. It's just as easy, just nobody knows. So just to say Mount Pisgah or Mount Nebo, whichever one it is. I know Mount Pisgah is more famous. There's Mount Pisgah Baptist churches all over the south where I'm from. There's one right down the street from me. Famous place. Deuteronomy 3, 18 through 20. Then I commanded you at that time, saying, remember now, Moses is still giving his speech to the people in the plains of Moab. He's just recounting his victories over Og and Bashan. Og of Bashan and Sion the Amorite. And he says, then after I won those victories, I commanded you at that time, after I won those victories, saying, the Lord your God has given you this land to possess it. All you valiant men shall cross over armed before your brothers, the sons of Israel. Now he's talking particularly to these two tribes, Reuben, Gad, and half Manasseh. All you valiant men shall cross over armed. That's because they made a deal with Moses. We'll go over and we'll help you capture Canaan land and conquer it for the other tribes, 9.5 tribes, but after we do that, we'll come back and take our land here. This was referred to in Numbers 32:29. Moses said to them, if the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben, everyone who is armed for battle, will cross with you over the Jordan in the presence of the Lord, and the land is subdued before you, then you shall give them the land of Gilead for possession. You, the western tribes, shall give the eastern 2.5 tribes Gilead. And that was the deal, and that's what happened. Now it says, the armed men shall cross over before your brothers. That means with, as John Gill says. These prepositions are sketchy. They didn't lead the charge, but they did participate in it. Now in verse 20, it says, Well, I guess I need to read verses 19 and 20. But your wives and your little ones and your livestock, I know that you have much livestock, shall remain in your cities which I have given you, until the Lord gives rest to your fellow countrymen as to you. And they also possess the land which the Lord your God will give them beyond the Jordan. Then you may return every man to his possession which I have given you. So the 2.5 tribes had to leave some troops back to protect their women and children and livestock in the cities they had, those 60 cities plus others. They had to do that. And when they got to come back to their women and children is when the Lord gave rest to your fellow countrymen. That means to the tribes on the west. Now this word rest is important because that rest, it means, as the NIV Study Bible says, peaceful, free from external threat and oppression, untroubled within by conflict, famine, or plague. And that word rest is also important because it's used in the New Testament scriptures as an antitype, the rest being a type, the antitype being rest in Jesus. So rest is a shadow, a picture, and rest in Jesus is the reality, the fulfillment. We see that in Hebrews 4:1. Therefore, while the promise to enter his rest remains, let us fear that none of you should miss it. Hebrews 4:3, first part of the verse, for we who have believed enter the rest. Well, just like these Israelites had to believe in order to enter into the rest of Canaan land, we have to believe to enter into the rest of Jesus. We go now to Deuteronomy 3, verses 21 through 25. I commanded Joshua at that time, saying, your eyes have seen all that the Lord your God has done to these two kings. That's Sihon and Og, the two Amorite kings. So the Lord shall do to all the kingdoms into which you are about to cross. And what he's saying is, you wiped out Sihon and Og, you're going to wipe out the Canaanites once you cross the river. Do not fear them, for the Lord your God is the one fighting for you. I also pleaded with the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord God, you have begun to show your servant your greatness and your strong hand, for what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do such works and mighty acts as yours? Let me, I pray, cross over and see the fair land that is beyond the Jordan, that good hill country and Lebanon. Well, Moses says in verse 22, don't fear the Canaanites because God is fighting for you. He had good object lesson. They had just wiped out these two Amorite kings. I mean, wiped them out, but good. So he's got something he can appeal to, and he says, don't fear, go on into the land. Now, verse 23 says, I pleaded with the Lord at that time. Now, it's not exactly clear what time Moses pleaded with the Lord. John Gill says it could have been when Moses was told that he was going to die and Joshua was to succeed him, which would be a little bit later. Or it could have been when the two kings were slain. It's all here at the end of the 40th year. The time doesn't need to be that precise. Moses wants to go into the promised land, and can you blame him? Why didn't he go into the promised land? Well, because God was angry with him when he struck the rock at Kadesh Barnea when the Israelites needed water. There's been many suggestions as to why God was angry with Moses and said, you can't go in. I just give you three. I think I had 12 options, but I'm going to give you just three right here. Moses struck the rock in anger, so he'd had no dignity when he represented God, so God could have been angry at that. Option number two, Moses violated God's instructions. God said, speak to the rock, but Moses struck the rock 40 years earlier, or maybe 39 years earlier, at Rephidim at the beginning of the Exodus. They were short of water, and Moses had struck the rock at Rephidim. God wasn't angry. In fact, God told him to strike the rock. But now, when God said to speak to the rock 39 years later, or 38 years later, at Kadesh Barnea, Moses didn't speak to the rock. He struck it. It's a good application here. You know, don't routinely repeat your methods and expect them to work. You got to hear from God all the way through. All right, so that's a good reason. Possibly Moses violated God's instructions about speaking. He struck instead. Third option is that Moses was proud. He claimed that he, not God, brought the water forth. In Numbers 20:10, we read this. Moses and Aaron summoned the assembly in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, listen, you rebels, must we bring water out of this rock for you? And the claim is made that that was showing arrogance. He should have said, must God bring water out of this rock for you? I don't really buy that. I don't see why you can blame Moses for saying, must we bring water out of the rock? But anyway, that's, like I say, that's controversial. There's lots of reasons. But the point is God was angry with Moses, and because of that, he could look at all this land, but he can't go in. We see here in Deuteronomy 31:2, at the end of all Moses' speeches, at the end of the book, he said to them, to the Israelites, I am 120 years old today. I am no longer able to come and go. And the Lord has said to me, you shall not cross this Jordan. So he was told that at the beginning of year 39, at Kadesh Barnea, which was roughly at the end of the year 39. And so he thought he one more time he would say, God, please let me go across. No. Moses, like Abraham, was to inherit the land only through his descendants. I remember reading in Genesis 15 so many times, and it hit me one time. I said, this promise is not to Abraham. It's to Abraham's descendants. Abraham was never promised to enter into the land. The land was to go to his descendants. Well, Moses would have to inherit through his descendants also. The land that he's not going to get to go into in verse 25 is called a fair land, or Moses called it a fair land. Deuteronomy 8:7 describes the land this way, for the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs, flowing forth in valleys and hills. The land is also called, Moses also calls the land in verse 25, that good hill country. Jameson Fawcett Brown has an interesting comment about the translation of that phrase, quote, that goodly mountain, as the KJV has it, is supposed by Jewish writers to have pointed to the hill on which the temple was to be built. But biblical scholars now generally render the words that goodly mountain, even Lebanon, and consider it to be mentioned as typifying the beauty of Palestine, of which hills and mountains were so prominent a feature. Well, my two modern translations, NASB and Holman Christian Study Bible, have that goodly mountain and Lebanon instead of even Lebanon, which makes sense to me. He looked out, he saw the whole land of Israel, looked to the north, and there was Lebanon. It was just as beautiful. Lots of trees. One other small point. In verse 24, Moses says, O Lord God. I just learned something here about English translations. Usually, Lord, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D is Yahweh. Y-H-W-H, which nobody knows how to pronounce. Some people pronounce it Jehovah. I just say Yahweh. And then God is usually translates the Hebrew word Adonai, which means master or Lord. But when you have the two words together, Yahweh Adonai, you have a problem with translation because you don't want to say, well, I guess you could say capital L-O-R-D. Well, actually, it's not. It doesn't work that way. It's O Adonai Yahweh. So you would have O lowercase L-O-R-D, uppercase L-O-R-D, and it would read like this, O Lord, Lord, which of course sounds terrible. So what they do is they take Adonai, they translate it as capital L, little O, little R, little D, and then Yahweh, instead of translating it as capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, they just switch it to God, capital G, capital O, capital D. So basically when you see capitals, either Lord or God, it's Yahweh. We go now to Deuteronomy 3, verses 26 through 29. We'll finish up this audio. But the Lord was angry with me on your account and would not listen to me. And the Lord said to me, enough, speak to me no more of this matter. Go up to the top of Pisgah and lift up your eyes to the west and the north and south and east and see it with your eyes, for you shall not cross over this Jordan. But charge Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him, for he shall go across at the head of this people. And he will give them as an inheritance the land which you will see. So we remained in the valley opposite Beth Peor. That's in the plains of Moab, right near Mount Pisgah. Now, this anger is different than the anger that when God was angry with Moses for striking the rock at Kadesh Barnea. This is angry. Well, actually, it is. That's the anger that Moses is referring to, the anger that God had with him because he struck the rock at Kadesh Barnea. But now the Lord said to me, enough, speak to me no more of this matter. This is a year or so later while they're in the plains of Moab. And after they had beaten Og and Sion, and Moses just couldn't help it. He says, please, God, let me go over. I know you told me about a year ago that you're not going to let me go over, but have you changed your mind? And God says, enough. You know, Moses was a prophet that spoke face to face with God, and that was a big advantage, but there's some disadvantages too. You got rebuked face to face too. And he said, the Lord was angry with me. Can you imagine talking to Yahweh face to face and finding out he was angry with Moses? Ooh, I wouldn't like that a bit. God was angry with Moses because of the Israelites, because he says, the Lord was angry with me on your account. In other words, because you grumbled at Kadesh Barnea about the water not being there, and I responded to your anger and screwed up, and now God's angry with me. But it was you started it. If you hadn't complained, I would not have got myself in this mess. That's what he's saying. Well, God gives Moses a consolation prize. He says, you're not going to go in, but you're going to see. So go up to the top of Mount Pisgah. That's where Moses is to die. Go up there and look. That's the last thing in your life. What you're going to see is that beautiful land, the promised land. And if you get up on top of Mount Pisgah, I'm sure I've never done it, but I know that because of the high mountains and because of the way the land works, you can see all across the Dead Sea. You can see the whole, all of the promised land from up there. And then in verse 28, God tells Moses, charged Joshua. The NIV has commissioned Joshua. I like that a little bit better. But charge Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him, for he shall go across at the head of this people. Now, Joshua needed to be encouraged and strengthened because it's still a military tough thing to do to wipe out all the Canaanites. Moses didn't want Joshua to end up like American troops in Afghanistan, humiliated and beaten. For he, Joshua, shall go across at the head of this people, and he will give them as an inheritance the land which you will see. Verse 29, so we remained in the valley opposite Beth Peor. Now, Beth Peor is somewhere around Mount Pisgah. It's in the plains of Moab, that area of Moab right to the east of the northern tip of the Dead Sea. Mount Pisgah's there, and also Beth Peor is there. Beth is house. Peor is I'm not sure what Peor is. I think it was a place name, and there was a Baal of Beth Peor called Baal Peor, and that was the place where the Israelites were seduced into sin by the Midianite women, with the Moabites urging the Midianite women on. You recall that story. It was a place where Baal of Peor was worshipped. We read this in Numbers 23:28. So Balak took Balaam to the top of Peor, which overlooks the wasteland. That's the mountain, probably. Numbers 25:3. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, the Baal that's there on that mountain where they had the cult, the altar. And the Lord was angry. Numbers 25:5. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor. So that was the famous, what I call the Baal of Peor incident, where the zeal of Phinehas occurred, where Phinehas stabbed Zimri and Cozbi. The Jewish man, and Cozbi, the Midianite woman, that were having sex. Probably they were having sex, and it was probably for religious reasons. And God put a plague on the people because of this, and Phinehas stopped the plague by killing those two. Well, that was a bad situation. But right across that valley here on Mount Pisgah, or in the valley opposite Beth Peor, they're getting ready to cross into the Promised Land. John Gill makes an interesting point about God being angry with Moses. He says that it must have, God's refusal to let Moses go in must have really bothered Moses, because Moses frequently takes notice of the fact that he had been refused entry. No less than 4 or 5 times. I don't have the scripture citations. I'll take Gill's word for it. Well, I don't blame him. After going through all that Moses went through to get the people right on the edge and then not be able to go in. Whew. Obedience, my friends. Disobedience has bad consequences. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Deuteronomy chapter 3, verses 1 through 29. Our next audio will cover Deuteronomy 4, chapters verse 1 through 40, where idolatry is forbidden to the Israelites. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.